can't solve a problem at the same level it was created.
I worked very hard for 10 years to become an overnight sensation.
Your growth has to be number one. That is the first rule.
You need to be able to imagine something being better.
And I think the fear is missing a life and not experiencing your full capacity.
The only way to learn to see is to make assertions, see what happens, learn from it, and then do it again.
You're listening to the Humans 2.0 podcast. This is your host, Mark Metry. You're listening to episode 297 of the Humans 2.0 podcast with Susan David. Susan is a psychologist at Harvard Medical School, co-founder, co-director of the Institute of Coaching at McLean Hospital, and CEO of Evidence-Based Psychology. He's a multiple-time best-selling author of Emotional Agility, Get Unstuck, Embrace Change, and Thrive in Work and Life. Susan and I went extremely deep about emotions, how to process them, how to not neglect them, what do they really mean, are you too emotional, are you not emotional enough. This is actually one of my favorite episodes ever. While you guys are listening to the show, if anything sticks out to you as thought-provoking or interesting, feel free to take a screenshot of what you heard and post it on your Instagram story, put it up on Facebook, LinkedIn, share it with your friends, share what you learned. Be sure to tag myself as well as Susan. And without further ado, episode 297. Okay, so Susan, the first question that I always start off and ask my guests is, how do you spend your time here on planet Earth?
I spend my time here on planet Earth being. I'm very focused on, trying to understand the world. And, you know, in formal job description, I'm a psychologist. I work at Harvard Medical School. I'm a co-founder of the Institute of Coaching. And I'm also a mom of two children. But I would say that I spend most of my time on Earth thinking and being.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Susan, I kind of discovered your work when, you know, I was really just trying to understand more of my emotions, because I'm very much kind of in the like self-improvement, self-development industry. And, you know, there are so many different things going on where, you know, people say like, oh, you know, you should just be happy, kind of suppress your emotions. There are people that say, you know, emotions aren't that important. But as I speak to more people, as I just develop as a human, I'm really learning just from my perception that emotions are sort of like these underlying, sort of a foundation in like our psychology. And a lot of us have sort of a different misunderstanding. And so I wanted to invite you on here because I, you know, out of all these people that I've sort of seen, there's a lot of people, you've been the clearest person to almost provide various analogies, various models to think about this, so we can actually sort of address this, because I believe that emotions are a major, major percentage that that are a part of our lives, that control different parts of behavior that we may or may not necessarily see at the surface level.
Yeah, absolutely. Most of my work has really focused on one core question. And this was, you know, in my PhD, beyond my PhD, and in my day-to-day work with organizations and individuals. And really the work focuses on, you know, what are the inner aspects of ourselves. So what are our thoughts, our emotions, and even, you know, the stories that we tell ourselves, because of course we have emotions that get interwoven with their narratives. And these things, our thoughts, emotions, and our stories fundamentally drive everything. They drive every aspect of how we love, you know, are we able to be intimate and vulnerable? They drive our parenting. Are we locked up in our stress, or are we able to engage with our children? They drive our leadership. You know, are we able to accept dissent and find it non-threatening? Are we able to innovate? Because, of course, the other side of innovation is that we need to be open to failure. And so we know, you know, that our thoughts and our emotions drive everything, every aspect of how we love and how we live, how we parent and how we lead. And, you know, this idea that emotions are, you know, somehow not part and parcel of what makes up for an effective, successful, and I use the word success very broadly. I don't just mean, you know, in a kind of financial way. But the idea that emotions don't play a part is, you know, just absolutely unfounded. Our emotions are fundamental. If we think about the most basic thing, you know, you're trying to be healthier, but you come home from work and you're feeling stressed, and that stress maybe gets in the way then of you going for a run. You can see how that small experience of a very simple behavior is in real ways impacted by your emotional space at the time. And so it's crucial for us as human beings to really move away from this narrative that our emotions are somehow soft or have no place no role to play in the way we are. They are essential.
I see. And so, you know, just to sort of kind of look at the big picture and get the lay of the land, how would you begin to even describe to someone like what an emotion is? Is it your thoughts? Does it go deeper than that? What are they?
Well, at our most basic level, so let me first say that, you know, even physiologists and psychologists are still discussing and describing what the actual parameters of this definition are. But at the most basic level, if we think about our emotions, it's a physiological response often to stimuli in our environment. And we may react to those stimuli, or we may actually even be creating our emotions as we go into context. For instance, if you are in a meeting and someone speaks to you in a particular way, you might have some kind of memory of being spoken to in that way by a parent. And so you might almost have an anticipatory emotion that gets created by that context. When we start then layering in thoughts, then you start saying, well, the emotion is no longer a pure emotion. Now it's become what we call a feeling, you know? So an emotion might be anxiety. The feeling might be, I'm feeling a sense that there's doom around me. And so what you're starting to see is you're starting to overlay your emotion in with a thought in a way that's far more experiential and embodied.
And what you, if I understand what you're saying, is that our feelings, you know, are sort of created from these emotions, but our feelings may or may not be an accurate representation of why that's happening.
Correct. So so we can have, you know, we can have a feeling in a meeting that we're being undermined. And if we lack emotional agility, the word that I use or the phrase that I use is emotional agility, we might have the feeling of, oh my goodness, I'm being undermined here. And if you don't have good emotional agility, you may say, I'm being undermined, so I'm just going to shut down. Or I'm being undermined, so I'm just going to leave the room. And that perception that you're being undermined may or may not be accurate.
That's so interesting. And you know, I'm curious to ask you, like, when you look at this, and if, like, when you look at the root cause, or if there even is one, I'm curious, does some of these connections that we make, just like from your research, from your book, does this have to do with sort of the beginning parts of our life? Because I know that sort of the way that we react and respond during our childhood has a big part to do with our emotions. But I'm curious, like, what does that have anything to do with our emotions, sort of the first parts of our lives?
Yeah. So firstly, I mean, we were talking a little bit earlier about how many people view emotions as being, you know, non-essential to effectiveness. And yet one of the first people who actually described emotions as being absolutely essential, critical, was actually Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin described how, you know, he's most known for his book, The Origin of the Species, but he described in a book, The Expression of Emotion in Man and Animals, he described how our emotions have evolved for us as human beings to help us to survive. So if you're going out in the world and you aren't able to see something or someone that's going to attack you, and you don't experience fear, then you're not going to live to fight another day. So what Charles Darwin described is how our emotions are functional. Our emotions basically have a function, and the function is that firstly, they help us to communicate with the world. You signal to someone, gee, I'm struggling here, I need help. Or you signal as a child to a parent, I'm sad, I feel unloved, I feel unseen. And that sadness is signaling a need that you have as a human being. But we also have our emotions as a function of signaling to ourselves. If you in a job that you are bored at, you know, you're feeling bored in your job, that that experience might be a signaling function that you, you know, need something different and you're not getting that something different right now. Or if you're feeling stressed, that stress might be signaling to you that you need to put some more routine or more order in place. So what happens is we have these emotions, and these emotions have evolved to help us in really important ways. Then, of course, we live in a society in which there are all these cultural narratives. And the cultural narratives are things like, oh, be happy all the time. You know, don't hang around with people who are negative. And so what we start doing is we start overlaying this beautiful functional element of our emotions with judgments and criticisms. We start second-guessing ourselves. We start rationalizing our emotions. In some research that I did, I found that around a third of us, when we experience normal emotions, emotions like fear, anxiety, grief, anger, these are normal emotions. Instead, what we do is we, you know, instead of just experiencing them and saying, what is this emotion trying to tell me? Instead, what we do is we judge them, we push them aside. So we've got a culture that then overlays a whole lot of, you know, other aspects to it. When you were talking about, okay, so we've got the emotion, but then we've got the interpretation of it. So we've got a culture that does that, but we also have what we call display rules. So display rules might be a rule when you were growing up in your family, not you specifically, but when someone's growing up in their family, they might have a display rule where every time they're sad, their parent rushes in and says, you know, with the best of intentions, don't be sad, don't be sad. Let's go bake cupcakes, you know, basically trying to kind of brush away the sadness. It's done with great intention. But what does it teach you? It teaches you that sadness is somehow to be feared. And what it stops you from doing is actually developing critical emotional skills, which is, for instance, if you think about depression, depression is the experience of sadness, but my sadness isn't going to pass. If you're a child and you've been allowed to be sad, what you learn very quickly is, gee, I was sad, and now 10 minutes later, I'm not sad anymore. You recognize that your emotion is transient. If you grew up in a family in which every time you were angry, you got punished, that display rule may actually lead you to struggle with anger later on in life. So when you are now given feedback in the workplace and you, you know, see a little bit of anger in your boss, but actually your boss isn't really angry with you. They're just a bit, you know, frustrated at something. Your ability to actually navigate and manage that may be challenged. And so, very long answer to a very short question, but yes, you know, our emotions are functional. And then what we do is, as we grow up, as we live in culture, we start kind of developing these really unhealthy habits when it comes to our emotions. And that can have a real impact on our well-being, on our health, you know, as I mentioned earlier, on our relationships and our ability to bring ourselves cleanly and with intention and purpose and our values to the things that are most important to us.
Wow. And so, correct me if I'm wrong, sort of what you're saying is that emotions are data for our lives. They help us navigate. At their best, they help us navigate the waters, whether we should be doing this or we shouldn't be doing that. And depending on, you know, our upbringing, you know, how we were raised, various cultural scripts that are going on that say you shouldn't do this, or if you look like this, you shouldn't do that, or you shouldn't feel that, that eventually end up creating, I don't want to say dysfunction, but end up creating maybe a lack of coherency between how you know, someone just goes throughout their lives and they feel these emotions, you know, come and go every day. But depending on sort of their upbringing, they may be almost blocking it due to some form of shame or guilt.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you a practical example of this. Imagine you are someone who's frustrated in your job, and so you haven't actually learned the skills to say, gee, what is going on for me here? Instead, you've been told that being frustrated is being negative and you should be positive. And, you know, I want to be clear, I've got nothing against about, you know, I've got nothing against happiness. But what happens is, so what you do now is you're frustrated in your job and you start rationalizing that emotion away. Well, I'm unhappy in my job, but at least I've got a job. So many people would give anything for this job. This is a job that makes my parents proud. So we've got all of this stuff. And so what you do is you push those emotions aside. 5 years later, you're still in the same job and you're still unhappy in the same job. But now you've lost the 5 years and you haven't in the meantime been upskilling yourself and readying yourself for something different. So at its most fundamental, when I talk about emotional agility in my book, emotional agility is about being able to be with your emotions in healthy ways so that you can respond effectively to the reality of the context that is at hand rather than your memories or what other people want, and then be able to move forward in your life towards your values. And so this is agility because you aren't being hooked into ways of being either by having a relationship with your emotions that leads you to block them out or suppress them. But it also, you know, allows you to, you know, learn from them and to be effective with them.
You know, that's so interesting. And, you know, lately I've had a lot of conversations with people around emotions and around shame. And it usually goes something like this, where, you know, emotions are not inherently good or bad, but a lot of the times, you know, due to our upbringing, our environment, our, you know, these cultural scripts, we begin to form a sense of guilt, which may become shame. And whenever this emotion arises, we just feel the emotion of shame, which prevents us from actually seeing this emotion clearly for what it is. And so, I mean, I don't know if what I said was right or wrong. You're the expert, but I'm curious, like, do you in your work speak on like shame specifically? Do you think that's worth kind of talking about?
Yeah. So I think firstly, what you describe, which is difficulty in distinguishing different emotions from one another, is really important. For instance, I speak about this a little in my TED talk as well. You know, people often use very big labels to describe very specific emotions, or sometimes even a misplaced label. So for instance, people might go through life saying, gee, I'm stressed. Okay, I get home from work, someone says, how was your day? And I say, I'm stressed. So if you think about it, there's a world of difference between stress and anxiety, or stress and that like gnawing feeling of, gee, I'm in the wrong job, or that feeling of stress of like, I'm overwhelmed and I need help here. If you label everything as stress, then it doesn't actually allow you to understand what is actually going on for me here. So what I found in my research, and there are many other pieces of research that support this, is that we want to, with our emotions, this is again emotional health and emotional agility, we want to, with our emotions, be differentiated, or what I call granular with emotions. So when we're much more granular, when we say, okay, I'm calling it stress, but what are one or two other options here? You know, what else might be going on for me? And it's a very simple way of being, you know, what else might be going on for me? What it allows us to do is to label that emotion for what it is. And that labeling has a very, very powerful psychological function. So when you label something as, ah, I'm overwhelmed, what it does is it helps you to understand the cause of that overwhelm and what scientists call the readiness potential in our brains. The part of our brains that actually starts getting us ready for movement becomes activated. So now what you're doing is you're not calling this thing stress anymore. You're saying, gee, what's going on for me is overwhelm, and what I've got to do is, you know, in very simple terms, make a to-do list. But you can see, so but you can see that depending on, you know, the emotion you're experiencing, if you get more granular with it, you are then able to start putting actions in place that are extraordinarily helpful in enabling you to actually deal with the situation. When you just call it stress, you're not dealing with it. When you get stuck in the emotion, when you're brooding on it and ruminating, again, you're not dealing with the situation. When you are bottling the emotion, pushing it aside and judging it, you're not dealing with it. So they're very, very important strategies that we need as human beings to enable us to deal with these emotions so that we can bring out the best of them. Because you said this earlier, and I think it's so critically important. Emotions are data. Emotions are data. But of course, they are not directives. Just because I feel frustrated with my husband doesn't mean I need to get divorced from him. Doesn't mean that he's like in the wrong, you know. I need to be able to say, I'm feeling this experience, but I don't need to listen to my emotions. I need to be able to be open enough to my emotions that I understand what they're telling me. But I don't need to obey the orders that my emotions are giving me. And this is a really, really critical distinction, because often when people say, you know, your emotions are destructive, or your emotions are, you know, you don't want to bring your emotions into the meeting. It's not that you don't want to bring your emotions into the meeting. It's that your emotions play a critical role in the meeting, but you don't want your emotions to be calling the shots. You want to be able to bring other parts of yourself into the meeting as well, because our emotions are important, but they're not definitional of us. They're not all of us. I've also got my values, my thoughts, my intentions, my plan, my strategy, my, you know, all the best parts of ourselves. And so when we get effective with our emotions, what we're doing is we are just opening ourselves up to the data. And we're saying, what is this emotion telling me that might be helpful to me here? I don't need to obey it. It's data. It's not directives.
I see. Oh man, I have to listen to this podcast episode and just kind of really sink this stuff.
You'd asked a question about, I felt like we were going on a little...
Shame.
Oh, yes. Okay, okay. So, of course, then what we need to do is we need to get really granular with our emotions. And when I talk about the idea that all emotions, you know, have a function, that even applies to sometimes very difficult emotions. So, for instance, sadness. You know, sadness is signaling to me that something that I value has been lost here. Anger is often telling me that there is this thing that I hold to be critically important that is being threatened. So when we think about something like guilt, you know, what is the function of guilt? Guilt and shame are really, really important human emotions. The world would not be able to move effectively were it not for guilt and shame. Guilt and shame are called social emotions. You know, they're what we call the social emotions. And they're the kinds of emotions that stop you from murdering someone that you don't like. You know, they basically help us to engage in ways that are really pro-social and that are helpful to us in society. But what sometimes happens is we start sometimes not to just experience an emotion, but we start feeling guilty about the fact that I'm experiencing the emotion. Or we start even having difficulty with emotions like guilt and shame. Guilt and shame are really interesting. So guilt is the experience of I have done the wrong thing. Okay, guilt is something that is focused on a specific behavior. I've done the wrong thing. Shame is a much more difficult experience of that type of emotion. Shame, when you're experiencing shame, you're no longer saying I've done the wrong thing. What you are starting to say is I am wrong. All of me is wrong. So guilt is focused on something specific. What happens with shame is we're starting to become the emotion. It's enveloping. And what's really fascinating is if you look at the research on how guilt and shame play out, imagine you've got a group of people who are in prison and they've all committed, you know, similar crimes. And you try to understand, do they feel guilt about their crime or do they feel shame? Guilt is I did this thing and I was wrong. Shame is I'm a bad person. This is awful. I am terrible. Mm. So now you look at this and you then look at when individuals are released from prison, what aspect of these emotions actually predicts whether they will reoffend or not. And what we find, which is so fascinating, is that when people feel guilt, they are less likely to reoffend. Because you can see, it's like, I did the wrong thing, I'm in charge, and I can choose not to do this wrong thing again. When I am wrong, when all of me is wrong, then no longer do you have a sense of agency about whether or not you do a particular behavior. You just are wrong. And so there's no point in even trying. And so shame, as it turns out, predicts reoffending, whereas guilt does not.
Wow. My mind is kind of being blown right now. And, you know, when I personally think of guilt, you know, I kind of use that as a sign, you know, of my character that says, you know, if I did something and I feel guilty, that's sort of, you know, my character, I guess, life telling me that I probably shouldn't do that. And it tries to guide me in the right direction.
Yes.
Whereas shame is, you know, I guess it could start from guilt and then it sort of seeps into not necessarily the action, but your character. Like the way that you even think about yourself.
It's enveloping. And I think this is really important for listeners. You know, we all make mistakes. We are absolutely beautifully imperfect human beings. And it's really important when we think of our language that we use towards ourselves. I did the wrong thing. I messed up this particular thing at work. Mm. But when we start moving into the space of shame, we now are no longer able to be constructive. And so just being aware of this, not punishing yourself then if you're shaming yourself, but being aware of this distinction is really powerful. And also, of course, the way we speak to children. You know, you did the wrong thing, but the messaging should never be you are bad.
Yeah, when we started this interview, that was like the number one thing going through my head of like every parent in the world needs to listen to your work, read your book. And so I'm curious to ask you, Susan, like for someone who, you know, does maybe they are aware that some of these emotions have some shame around them. I'm curious, like, do you have like, aside from maybe conscious awareness, is there like a step one or something like that somebody can do to begin to relieve this? Because I know personally for me, shame has been something like, you know, it becomes a part of your character, something that's very, very deep. And I'm curious to ask you, for someone who kind of finds themselves in that spot, do you have like a methodology or a way to begin to kind of peel back the layers of this?
Yeah. And I think this, it's such an important question. It really applies to all of our difficult emotions. And it's this, all of these narratives that are about be happy all the time, you know, only be happy, it's all about happiness, they are fundamentally unhealthy. As I mentioned, they get us into the space of basically being in constant struggle with ourselves. So again, I'm not anti-happiness, but when you look at the research, what we find is that people who are overly focused on, I've got to be happy, I've got to be happy, actually tend to become less happy over time. You know, there's a lot of research that shows that there's a degradation of people's levels of happiness and well-being the more they focus on happiness as like some kind of goal, you know, some kind of endpoint. We also know that people who treat happiness as the good emotion and all of the other emotions as bad emotions, what they're more likely to do is they're more likely to try push those difficult emotions aside. And this doesn't actually work. What we know is that when people push aside difficult emotions or even difficult thoughts, there's something that psychologists call amplification. And amplification is this idea that when you try not to think about something or when you try to push it aside, it actually has a rebound effect. So we've all had this experience, okay? You're trying to be healthy. You're trying not to think about the chocolate cake in the refrigerator, you know. What do you think about constantly? the chocolate cake in the refrigerator, because it actually takes cognitive resources to push thoughts and feelings aside. And those cognitive resources actually then make us less able to deal with the reality of everything else that's going on in our environment. So we know that when people push difficult emotions aside, there's actually a huge impact on relationships. You know, people are pushing difficult emotions aside. We know that it is associated with lower quality relationships. When people push emotions aside, as I mentioned earlier, you're then not solving the problem that's facing you. So there's a degradation in problem solving. And we also know that people who constantly push emotions aside have significantly lower levels of well-being, high levels of depression, high levels of anxiety, and so on. So what do we know about emotional agility and emotional health? The first thing that I talk about in my work is the critical ability to show up to your emotions with compassion. And what do I mean here? Instead of being involved in the hustle of whether you should or shouldn't feel something, just open your heart to the fact that you feel what you feel, that there is enough space in you as a human being to feel all of your emotions. Yes, the happy, joyful emotions, but there's enough space in all of us for sadness. There's enough space for guilt and for anger. We are bigger than a single emotion. And so when we do away with trying to push these emotions aside and we just become accepting and compassionate towards ourselves, what it does is it almost, you know, ends the struggle. You kind of just dropping the rope. You're saying, I'm not going to be in that struggle anymore. And so this is firstly very, very, very important. I think especially important in a world in which we almost sometimes feel as if we're like in a never-ending Iron Man or Iron Woman competition where we've always got to, you know, be our best. And somehow this idea that when we feel bad, we should – it's a sign of weakness. Just open compassion is step one. Because our emotions are data. Then we want to also say, my emotions are data, but they're not directives. So how can I be compassionate with my emotions, but also have a healthy distance from them? And this is, again, really critical. And this, the example that I described earlier where you're putting a label on your emotion is an example of how you get a healthy distance. You know, you're now like not in a, oh my goodness, I'm stressed. You know, what I'm feeling is overwhelm. I can do something with that. So that's one strategy. Another strategy is noticing your thoughts and feelings and stories for what they are. They are thoughts, they are feelings, they are stories. They are not facts. So what can happen is sometimes we treat our thoughts, our feelings, and our stories as fact. You know, we might climb into a story that was written on our mental chalkboard in grade three about whether we're creative or not. And now we want to apply for a job that requires some kind of creativity. And that story comes and says, oh, don't forget, you're not creative. You can't apply for this job. So it's really important for us to be able to know that we are not our thoughts, our emotions, and our stories. And instead, we can see them for what they are. And how do we do this? Let me give you a basic example, but that I think is incredibly powerful. All of us use this language. I am sad. I am stressed. I am angry. When you say I am, what you are doing is you linguistically are making all of you 100% of you, I am, is that emotion. All of me. Okay? But you are not your emotion. Your emotion is a data source to be understood and evaluated, but you are not your emotion. So instead of saying, I am sad, I'm noticing the feeling of being sad. Instead of saying, I am not creative, I'm noticing that that's my I'm not creative story. This sounds really simple, But again, to bring us to that beautiful sentiment that's conveyed by Viktor Frankl, you know, between stimulus and response, there is a space, and in that space is our power to choose. And in that choice lies our growth and freedom. When there's no space between stimulus and response, we just say, I am, and we're just treating it as fact, and therefore we're not applying for the job. But when we start creating linguistic space, I'm noticing the feeling. I'm noticing that's the story. What we do is we create space. And the metaphor here that I think is just so beautiful is when we are hooked by a thought, an emotional story, in a way that stops us from being our best. What we are doing is we are treating the thought emotion story as us. We are, you know, we are, if you imagine clouds in the sky, we are the cloud, we are the sadness, we are the anger, we are the story. But as human beings, we are not any one cloud. We are the sky. We are the sky, and we are big enough to have many different clouds in our sky. We are the sky.
That's everything you said, Susan, is so powerful. I'm writing a lot of these steps down. And I love, you know, one is, you know, the real priority to, you know, like you said, be compassionate, kind of look at our thoughts more curiously, not try to judge them right away, and then kind of understand that, you know, they're not, like you said, they're not directives. They're not like, you know, telling you what to do, but they're data. Yeah. And I think that's so powerful. And I remember for me, when I realized that, you know, it was almost as if, you know, at least one part, like the veil was sort of lifted of like my everyday life. And it kind of went from, you know, like my brain was almost like running on like a movie script of what a character would say. And the second you realize that it's not necessarily the case and your brain is just producing, you know, these thoughts. I don't know how many like the average thoughts that person has a day, but I read something that was like 30,000 or 50,000, or I'm not 100% sure. But when you see it that way and you begin to label it and you begin to use more specific language, it really helps you process it when those clouds do come and you have that perspective.
Yes.
And I want to make a note on what you said on unhappiness. And, you know, it's so important because I remember for me, you know, when I was growing up, I felt like I definitely was not happy. And I felt like I was just always seeking happiness. And by the time I had grown up a little bit and I had, you know, gone on the path of sort of self-development and sort of becoming the real authentic version of myself, trying to chase happiness really became a goal of mine. And I remember, like a year and a half into my journey, I ended up realizing that it puts you in this very toxic cycle where someone will begin to start changing their life. They'll begin to start adding, you know, whether it's new habits or they'll start reading books or they'll start sort of adding things that they want in their life, and they'll sort of see a great deal of progress. They'll see a great deal of change, and that might make someone happy. But then, you know, life happens. There are ups and downs. You know, you're not always on like an exponential growth chart of your happiness, of your self-development. And then you kind of start feeling like, you know, you're a little bit more unhappy. And that was actually one of the main reasons of why I started my podcast. I felt like I was stagnating. And kind of through understanding this, I've really realized that, you know, if you view happiness that way, it's going to put you in a very, very dysfunctional feedback loop. Yes. That almost sort of traps you inside of your head.
Yes. It's so interesting. I often think of happiness in this way. Happiness, the expectation of happiness is a disappointment waiting to happen. Because life, you know, the expectation of happiness is a disappointment waiting to happen because life's going to come and life's going to go and there's going to be heartbreak and there're going to be times where things didn't work out. And if you start then taking, in psychology, we think of these, you know, thoughts sometimes as like, you've got your type one experience and that's, I want to be happy. But then you start layering it in with what we call type two, you know, I'm unhappy about the fact that I'm unhappy. Then, you know, you're in this like never ending cycle. So then it becomes really important to say, well, okay, if I can't focus on happiness as a goal. How is happiness, like, how does it actually come about? And happiness actually comes about through, it's a side product of a life that is lived in a way that feels coherent and that is congruent with our values. So when we are doing stuff that's meaningful and when we are with ourselves in ways that are curious and compassionate and courageous, because sometimes we're showing up to, you know, emotions that are difficult, that gives off ultimately the you know, side experience of happiness. But it's not a goal. It's not a goal. Can we actually come back to one thing that you said that was so interesting that so you mentioned earlier how, okay, so human beings have around 16,000 unspoken thoughts every single day. And we have many, many more that course through our minds. Some of them are so-called positive, some are so-called negative, and the same happens with emotions. There is nothing inherently good or bad about any thought. You know, we know that people have, you know, crazy obsessive thoughts, people have thoughts that are good, people, okay, so there's nothing inherently wrong or that should be judged about any thought or emotion that we have. That is our body, our psychology doing the job that it was meant to do, which is to judge and analyze and prepare us for safety as human beings in the world. Okay, so how do we then understand, when are we entering into the stage of a thought or emotion not being effective? So the language that I use is that when we get hooked into a thought or an emotion or a story that's not serving us, that's not serving our values, that's driving us in directions that are actually incongruent with who we want to be. It's keeping us in bed instead of going out and living life. It's stopping us from putting our hand up for that job. It's stopping us being intimate with someone because we're scared we're going to be rejected. So there's nothing inherently good or bad about a thought or an emotion or even a story. Stories help us to create context in our lives. What happens, we become inagile, we become ineffective when we get hooked into a thought, an emotion, a story. It starts owning us, calling the shots, and taking us away from who we want to be in the world. That by definition then is a thought, emotion, a story that you know is now just unhelpful. Another really important aspect of these emotions is that I haven't mentioned yet, but I think it's really critical. You know, we've been speaking about this idea that emotions are data. Data of what? You know, data of what? So the way that I think about it in my work is that our most difficult emotions contain signposts to the things that we care about. We tend not to feel a strong emotion about something that doesn't matter to us. So if you feel rage when you watch the news, that rage might be a signpost that you value fairness and equity and that you aren't seeing it in the world. If you feel guilt as a parent, that guilt might be a signpost that you value presence and connectedness with your children and that you don't have enough of it right now. If you feel bored in your job, that boredom might be a sign that you value growth and learning and you don't have enough of it now. So our emotions are signposts to the things that we care about. If we slow down and we say, what are the data here? What is the value that this emotion is pointing to? Then what we're doing is, we're no longer in this thing where we're saying, oh, you know, I feel guilty, I feel like I'm a bad parent, therefore I am a bad parent. We're now no longer in that space where we're treating our emotion as fact. We're starting to say, the guilt is signposting to me that I value presence and connectedness with my children, and I haven't had enough of it lately. How can I bring more presence and connectedness into my life at the moment? I'm working so hard. I'm traveling nonstop. what are some things that I can do? You know, when I'm in that hotel room, I can actually, instead of surfing the web while speaking to my kids on the phone, I can be more present with them. So this is, you know, it's not just about, oh, we want to be emotionally healthy. It's that when we function in ways that allow us to be curious and compassionate with our emotions, they point us to our values. And if we can then encompass and make ourselves able to hold onto discomfort in the movement towards our values, that's when we get growth. And what do I mean here? Mm. You know, I might be comfortable in my boring job, as an example, and it might take a lot of courage for me to be with the discomfort that helps me to move in the direction of my value, which is learning. So I might actually need to be able, and you know, it demands of me often that I am more embracing of discomfort. And you know, the language that I use in my TED talk is, you know, I say, you know, discomfort is the price of admission to a meaningful life. We don't get to build a family or to leave the world a better place or to have a career that we love without stress and discomfort. Discomfort is the price of admission to a meaningful life.
That's so important, because I know, for one, maybe consciously or unconsciously, I kind of felt like I had a narrative that wasn't supposed to happen. And one day I'll reach this state where I'll be happy and the sadness, anxiety, it won't exist. And that's just simply not what it's like to be a human being, like you've noted. And, you know, Susan, I definitely want to ask you about, you know, I don't know exactly when this podcast will air. I'm going to try to get it up early. But, you know, for the most part, you know, most of the world right now is in a very unique experience of kind of being quarantined. You know, everyone's at their house, maybe by themselves or just like with their family, and not really going out too much in public. And I don't know, for one, I mean, this whole conversation has been excellent for somebody, you know, kind of struggling to deal with that. But I'm curious to ask you, because I've noticed for me, like when I'm inside for a while, I think they call it like cabin fever, I definitely feel my emotions heighten. And I definitely think a part of it is because, you know, I like to think I'm productive. I like to think I hustle. I like to travel. I do all these things. And then now, you know, sort of sitting down, relaxing, I feel like has also not necessarily stirred emotions, but it's been able me to sort of pause and realize a lot of these emotions that are bubbling up that I almost think I ignored just by trying to hustle. Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious to you, like, I mean, what has your experience been like through this? And what advice would you give people who sort of may experience this situation because of sort of the way that the world is right now and what it's having us to do with sort of limiting our environments?
Yeah. There's a very interesting study actually that was done in which people were given a choice of whether they would A, sit alone quietly in a laboratory, or B, give themselves instead an electric shock. And around 70% of people chose to give themselves an electric shock, because as human beings, and particularly in the modern world, we are so unused to just being with ourselves, you know, just being with ourselves in a way that is, you know, unfettered by appointments and meetings and, you know, all of these kind of things. And so I think, you know, what you describe, and I'm not saying that this is part of what your experience was, but I do think sometimes that in the runaround of everyday life, we don't spend a lot of time actually going deeper and, you know, going inside. And so I think that you know, doing that, you know, really what we've got here is an opportunity or a context in which that has been almost forced upon us is discomforting. Like it's unusual for us. Yeah. It's discomforting. And I think being compassionate with it and saying, like, you know, this, I'm doing the best I can, you know, with who I've got, and what I am, you know, in this particular situation is really powerful. And then I think also, you know, again, it points to things that you value. So on the one hand, it might be that like all the hustle is actually avoidance. Or it might be, or it might be that you know, the hustle is something that gives you a sense of achievement and growth and connection and a sense of progress, and that those are things that are really important to you. And so then the opportunity becomes to ask yourself, even in the context of this difficulty, which I didn't choose, what are ways that I can use the time that I've got to connect more with those things that I know are important to me? You know, what are some things that I could be doing or projects I could be taking on that are important? And I think, you know, it's the same for me. I mean, I'm not like immune from this. You know, my husband's a physician. I know that in the next couple of days, he's already been at the MGH, you know, pretty much in the thick of it. But I know there's a very good chance that in the next couple of days, he's going to need to move out the house because he's really worried about bringing it back home. He's like trying to design masks to protect them. I've got two young children who are out of school. And I, you know, I'm not immune from this at all. I think it goes from spaces of, you know, being very distracted, but to also then recognizing that in order to gain and regain our foothold, we need to still ourselves. We need to move out of the space of the constant never-ending fact-checking, Twitter-feeding, statistics-checking, etc., into thinking about, you know, who do we want to be right now, you know, even in the context of this imperfection.
Yeah, I mean, I think right now is such an important time to deal with that. And my sister's husband actually is a chief resident at a hospital in New York. And so she's had to do the same thing and kind of move in with me. But, you know, nonetheless, it's, I think that, you know, events like this happen, and they really, you know, with compassion and judgment, really kind of show us, you know, who we are. And so, Susan, thank you so much for coming on. One of my goals this year was to improve my emotional flexibility, and you've definitely given me a good goal, a vision to head towards. I highly recommend people check out your book, Emotional Agility. And Susan, the last thing that I have my guests do here is leave the audience with some sort of a self-inquisitive question that somebody can ask themselves, and or a, you know, a simple exercise that somebody can take action on right after listening to this podcast.
Sure. So, okay. So I think the question that I would ask is, who's in charge, the thinker or the thought? Okay. Is the thought in charge? Is the thought bossing you around? Is the thought calling the shots? Or are you the person, expansive, able to have values and intentions and purpose? Are you in charge? So the question that I would ask is, who's in charge, the thinker or the thought? In terms of exercises, you know, one of the things I've spoken a bit about is values. You know, emotions point towards our values and so on. And a lot of times people say, you know, how do I actually even begin to think about my values? I've been so busy living my life that I don't really even know how to think about, you know, doing my values. So two quick things that I think people find helpful. The first is, I've got a quick free quiz that 120,000 people have taken. It takes 5 minutes to complete, and you get a free 10-page report. And that, if you're interested, you can find that at susandavid.com/learn. And then the second thing, just in relation to values, is just this question, which is, who do I want to be right now? And spending a little bit of time just like thinking about, you know, it might be that you're sitting in quarantine, or it might be that you're facing job loss, or something else, that you're having difficulty in your relationship. And just spending a little bit of time actually writing down, and it doesn't need to be complex, like just 3 or 4 minutes spending time writing down, who do I want to be even in the context of this struggle, is incredibly powerful in helping you to bring your values front and center. And this, as it turns out, what we call values affirmation, is exceptionally important when it comes to protecting our health and our well-being and helping us to bring the best of ourselves forward in the context of a beautiful and right now very fragile world.
I was just about to mention your quiz. People can definitely check that out. I haven't taken it yet, but I definitely will. We'll have links below to your website, any of your social media handles, your TED Talk, your book. And yeah, Susan, thank you so much for coming on. This has been such a true, you know, honor, kind of taking a deeper look at a lot of these things that are happening underneath the surface that have a big role to play in our lives that a lot of us may or may not necessarily have a good strategy or a great conceptual understanding of, kind of understanding these things and being aware of them. And so, Susan, thank you so much. Yeah, of course. This has been your host. Yeah, absolutely. This has been your host, Mark Metry. Thank you all for listening.
Hey, you made it to the end of the podcast. It's your host, Mark Metry, and I just want to take a moment here and sincerely acknowledging you for taking the time out of your own day, your own life, to invest it into listening to this podcast to gain something valuable and implement into your life to make it better. This is what it's all about. Now, if you actually gain value from this episode and you want to give me value somehow, I would unbelievably appreciate it if you went to Apple Podcasts, iTunes, if you have an Apple product where you listen to podcasts, and please leave this show a review. You are free to send me a message, email. Contact information is in the description below. Thank you so much for listening. Let's get this grassroots movement going.